and behave. You either see yourself as a victim of what happens to you, or as someone given opportunity to change, grow, see differently, and expand. You either see uncomfortable feelings as suffering you have to deal with, or signals you have to learn from. You either see the world as something that makes you feel, or you see your interpretation of the world as a projection of your feelings. When we think there is a purpose for our pain, the discomfort of it dissolves. It turns from an annoyance to an opportunity. Our suffering ceases. The difference between this mindset, intrinsic, and the opposite, extrinsic, is whether or not we believe that we create our experience, or that our experiences are created for us and imposed on us from an external force. We spend most of our lives being taught that the latter is true, and there's a reason for this. Society likes to believe it thrives when we are extrinsically motivated. At least, this is how capitalism runs. This is how people stay in power. This is how we are kept small. When people believe that they are victims, they forfeit their power. They funnel their energy on other people's ideas, dreams, products. Do we know for certain that there is some higher plan in which we confront obstacles in order to grow? Nope. But we never will. What we do know is that people who are able to create happy lives for themselves right here and right now are the ones who think that way. Unbearable suffering awaits us all. A brief glimpse through history can confirm none of us is guaranteed a happy life. If we want meaning, we have to create it. If we want to find peace, we need to know there's a purpose for suffering. You will either sit in discomfort for the rest of your life, or you will grow and be better for the things that are most difficult. It is very clear who does what. 24. How to know when the only thing in the way of your happiness is you. 1. The only problem with your life is the way you think about it. Objectively, you have everything you could ever want or need, yet your unhappiness simply comes from a lack of appreciation, which is a cultivated trait, if not a practice. 2. The solution to most of your problems is just changing the way you think about them. For example, learning that people's opinions of you are largely projections of how they see themselves would solve your problem, which is evaluating your life through the idea of how other people could perceive it. 3. You're mentally lazy. You know you should be more present, but you won't put in the effort to practice it. You know you should meditate and learn to train your brain to focus so it doesn't become engulfed by negativity, but you head to the gym instead. You're lazy in the way it matters most, and that's your biggest problem. 4. You've accomplished things you thought would make you happy and immediately shifted them from goals to notches on the belt. Once you achieved something, you immediately started to think of it as another thing done rather than another thing in my life to enjoy. 5. You haven't practiced holding the emotion of happiness. We all have a tolerance for how good we'll let ourselves feel, our upper limit. To go past it, we have to actually practice letting ourselves feel, otherwise we'll self-sabotage, bring ourselves back to our comfort zones. 6. You care more about comfort than you do about change. You'd rather remain moderately uncomfortable than deal with the uncertainty that is making a real change in your life. 7. You consciously choose to spend time with people who aren't good for you, meaning they don't really care about you, or they inspire you to behave in a way that is counter to what you're trying to achieve. In other words, they bring out the worst in you, yet you continue to see them anyway. 8. You won't let your idea of yourself evolve. You're stuck in only being comfortable thinking of yourself the way you were 3, 5, 10 years ago, because that's how other people are comfortable seeing you. 9. You choose what you think should be right rather than what actually is. You're more loyal to the ideas you have about things and the honest reality you know them to be. 10. You won't apologize. To yourself, nor to others. You're not open to being wrong. And certainly not to taking the ego hit, that is admitting you didn't always do your best. Yet doing this is a first step in changing that. 11. You haven't fully taken responsibility for your life. You're still waiting for something to come and change how you feel. Often people choose to suffer loudly because they believe it is a cry to the universe, as in, if they are transparent enough about how bad things are, something or someone else will eventually have to fix or change them. 12. You've ascribed happiness to a level of accomplishment rather than a state of being. You think that only some people can be happy because their life circumstances are ideal. Rather than choosing to seek happiness in the moment and realizing that has nothing to do with it. 13. You think that happiness is a sustained state of feeling good when it is really a higher baseline for perception. You are better able to process every emotion, and because you do so healthfully, you return to your general state of contentment quickly. 14. You accept what you're taught, even if it doesn't feel right. You're more trusting of dogma, teaching, or religion, simply because you knew it first, not because it resonates or helps you in a real way. 15. You have a good life, and you know you have a good life. At the end of the day, you know it's just about choosing to focus on it more. 25. The psychology of getting unstuck and the three stages of making habits autonomous. Success is more a product of habit than it is skill. To excel at something, you must be able to do it prolifically. Many people write well. Few people write well and consistently. What separates experts from the rest of us is a blend of profound self-control, disciplined routine, and unwavering dedication. While natural skill is more or less something you're born with, self-control is something you develop. Most people believe the opposite is true, that they can perfect their talent, but that the drive to do so will come easily. Our minds have a limited means for self-control. This is to say, we are only capable of withholding ourselves from our impulses and desires for a period of time each day. With practice, we can extend that period, but it is finite regardless. People who understand this use their time wisely. They eliminate unnecessary decision-making, reduce distractions, minimize what doesn't matter, and then they focus. Over time, it becomes second nature. In fact, in the 1960s, psychologists identified three specific stages we must go through in order to acquire those new skills. Cognitive. When we first intellectualize a task, make mistakes, and ultimately devise new strategies to perform better. Associative. When effort is still required to complete the task, but it's less mentally strenuous than it was. Some aspects of the task are beginning to come naturally. Mistakes are still being made. Autonomous. We go into autopilot, or in some cases, flow. We can release ourselves from conscious focus and let our programming take over. However, it is sometime between the last two phases that we get caught in a sort of plateau. We do the task often enough, but our expectation of how we should perform is still miles away from how we think it should be. It is what Ira Glass calls the creative gap, the point at which most people give up. For the first couple years you make stuff, it's just not that good. It's trying to be good. It has potential, but it's not. But your taste, the thing that got you into the game, is still killer. And your taste is why your work disappoints you. A lot of people never get past this phase. They quit. If you are just starting out, or you are still in this phase, you gotta know it's normal. And the most important thing you can do is do a lot of work. Put yourself on a deadline so that every week you will finish one story. It is only by going through a volume of work that you will close that gap, and your work will be as good as your ambitions. And I took longer to figure out how to do this than anyone I've ever met. It's gonna take a while. It's normal to take a while. You've just gotta fight your way through. the difference between the people who persevere to see that their work rises to their standard and the people who toss in the towel is not one of sheer, unprecedented talent. It's just a matter of having the, often uncomfortable, commitment to keep growing. If you don't have the desire nor the ability to push past the plateau, then an exodus is a means of showing you that there's something else better suited for you. If you do, it means you must eliminate the unnecessary details, work with your current threshold for self-control, and keep going. Getting unstuck is realizing that you were never stuck in the first place. You only stopped to ask yourself, "Is this what I'm here for?" 26. The one question to ask yourself if you're tired of fighting for someone's love. We talk a lot about how to get love. In fact, we talk about it incessantly. How to land a date, turn someone on, find a boyfriend, make yourself respected, admired, seen as successful. We talk about how to convince someone to commit, to get married, to take us out again. All of these things are the ways we try to manipulate the love that people give us. We talk a lot about how to get love, but we talk very little about how to give it. We talk about getting love as though it's a precursor to giving it, as though giving, if we aren't receiving, makes us weak, as though no respectable person would keep being kind and loving to someone who didn't love them back, as though being loving is being devoted, rather than being strong and honest and true and sometimes walking away. You cannot convince someone to love you if they don't. This, above most else, is a rule. Love is not something you get. It's not something someone else has and you must earn. It is not something that exists outside of you. When someone doesn't want to express affection and love and respect to you, you have two choices. You can try to change that fact and keep yourself stuck, or you can keep giving love, which will let you move on. The pain of not having love is the pain of your heart being closed. The pain of losing love is the pain of your heart closing. The pain of losing love is trying to change or manipulate someone into thinking or seeing you differently. It is not actually a loss of love. It is a step into delusion and denial. It is the adoption of the idea that you aren't lovable as you are. Love is not something anybody can take away from you, though. It's not something anybody can truly give you, either. It's not something you get. It's something you experience. And that exchange requires an equal and honest and willing contribution on each side. It's not something that anybody is responsible to do for you or owes you in a life. If you go on living as though other people are required to give you love, you will never actually experience it. If you go on living as though love is something that is always required of you, you will find it in everything. In every stranger on the subway, 3-date-long relationship, 6-year love affair that almost was it and everything else. All of these different loves become equally important. The pain of losing transmutes into the beauty of having discovered something more important than someone who can promise you forever. Your life turns into a series of little love stories, all of which teach you how to love better, how to give more, how to be more of yourself, what you like and what you don't, how to walk away with grace and respect yourself genuinely and listen to your intuition. When you want to pity yourself over how little love you're getting, I ask you to stop and consider, how much are you giving? 27. Be where your feet are. Mantras that will remind you that your life is happening in this moment. Presence is all we have, yet it often becomes a last priority. We know it's important to be in the moment, but if it were as simple as saying it, we'd have an easier time doing it. In a world that is constantly demanding more and more of our attention, we can't forget to give ourselves to what matters most, a glimpse at what's happening right now. Everything you've ever dreamed, wanted, worked for, wished for, and are waiting for stems from this moment. What you do now is not just something, it's everything. Here, 15 little mantras that you can repeat to yourself when you need to reground and remember. Life happens in a series of moments, and any other ideas are just illusions that keep you from it. 1. All that exists is what's in front of me. 2. Potential unrealized becomes pain. 3. The only way to be extraordinary depends on what I do with the ordinary. 4. Little by little. 5. All we ever have is now. 6. If I had the life I wanted, what would today look like? 7. If I had the love I wanted, what would today look like? 8. Start where you are. Use what you have. Do what you can. 9. What are the most important things that must happen today? 10. My life consists of my days. What am I doing with this one? 11. What would my most fully realized self do with today? 12. Am I truly doing the best I can right now? 13. If I didn't feel tired, what would I do today? 14. Be where your feet are. 15. I am here. 28. 16 questions that will show you who you are and what you're meant to do. Understanding who we are has less to do with discovery and more to do with remembrance than is typically understood. Have you ever had a realization that didn't precede a laundry list of examples, isolated moments and meaningless experiences and random relationships that compile to reveal a pattern or truth? Probably not. The real work of anything is simply becoming conscious of what is already true. The essential point of a psychological guidance system, religious or not, rather, the kinds that work, is not to supplant a mindset into you. Rather, it's to give you the tools for introspection, to figure out the answers yourself, to pose questions, to give examples, to have you reflect and through that recognition connect to your inner guidance system, your intuition, and your essential self. I say this with complete sincerity. The answers to these questions are some that have literally changed the course of my life. I'd be remiss not to have compiled and shared them. So, here you go. The 16 most important questions you will ever ask yourself. 1. What and who is worth suffering for? 2. What would you stand for if you knew that nobody would judge you? 3. What would you do if you knew that nobody would judge you? 4. Based on your daily routines, where will you be in 5 years? 10. 20. 5. Whom do you admire most and why? 6. What do you not want anybody else to know about you? 7. What are a few things you thought you would never get over while you were going through them? Why did they seem so insurmountable? How did you? 8. What are your greatest accomplishments so far? 9. What would be too good to believe if someone were to sit down and tell you what's coming next in your life? 10. Who from your past are you still trying to earn the acceptance of? 11. If you didn't have to work anymore, what would you do with your days? 12. What are the 5 most common things in your daily routine aside from the basics, such as eating and sleeping? 13. What do you wish those 5 most common things were instead? 14. If you really believed you didn't have control over something, you'd accept it as a matter of fact. What do you struggle to accept that you have no control over? What part of you makes you think or hope otherwise? 15. If you were to walk through your home and put your hand on every single thing you own, How many of them would make you sincerely feel happy or at peace? Why do you keep the rest? 16. What bothers you most about other people? What do you love most in other people? What bothers you most about yourself? What do you love most about yourself? Dig until you see the correlation. 29. How to know you've evolved more than you give yourself credit for. It's hard to see how far along the path you've come while you're so focused on taking each step, so to say. You've probably had the experience of a third party commenting on how much you've changed, but barely being able to realize only because you're with yourself each day. This is normal, but is also the product of focusing on what's left to do rather than what you've already accomplished, which is why it's often hard to give yourself the credit you really deserve. Here, a few little signs you've evolved more than you realize. 1. You have something in your life that you would have previously considered impossible, or at least a dream come true. Sobriety, a degree, a partner, a dream job. 2. You forget how much you've gone through simply because it doesn't cross your mind anymore. Your past seems like it happened in a different life. 3. Your criteria for a romantic type are personality traits, not physical characteristics. Your idea of love has expanded beyond the feeling that sexual attraction gives you. 4. You have more than just your problems to talk about with friends. More interests you than just gossip, as you've learned that those conversations have very little to do with other people and absolutely everything to do with you. 5. The worst happened, and then it passed. You lost the person you thought you couldn't live without, and then you kept living. You lost your job, then found another one. You began to realize that safety isn't in certainty, but in faith that you can simply keep going. 6. You've created your own belief system, if not entirely and thoroughly questioned your existing one. You no longer subscribe to anything that doesn't resonate or make sense to you. 7. You're more discerning of who you spend your time with. You value your closest friends more than you do the idea of a group. 8. You don't change any part of yourself, your personality, your opinions, even your clothes, based on whom you're going to be around that day. 9. You don't blame other people for your problems anymore. You don't choose to suffer because you assume if you complain loudly enough, the universe will have to fix it. 10. You don't relate to a lot of your old friends anymore, but you can still keep in touch and appreciate the role they had in your life. 11. You're not worried about fitting in anymore. You sincerely don't want to be normal, and you sincerely do not care about being cool, as you now see that the cool kids usually don't get very far past high school. 12. You can talk about the problems in your life that you thought you'd absolutely never get over, and you can also talk about exactly how you got over them. 13. You stop and enjoy life more often, rather than just sprinting from goal to goal. 14. You're highly skeptical of anything that's fed to you as being just the way things are. You're always open to the idea that there could be a different, better, kinder, more enlightened way to live, and you're always willing to at least try for it. 15. If you were to tell your younger self about the life you have now, they sincerely wouldn't believe you. 30. Signs the only problem with your life is the way you think about it. 1. You generally spend more time thinking about your life than you do actually living it. You spend more time dissecting problems than you do coming to solutions, more time daydreaming than you do asking yourself what those thoughts indicate is lacking or missing in your waking life, or coming up with new solutions, as opposed to actually committing to the ones that are already in front of you. You've replaced reflection with experience and wonder why you feel unfulfilled. 2. You don't find wonder in the simple pleasures the way you once did. You think nature is boring, and play is for children, and there's nothing awe-inspiring about a shaft of light through the window, or a stranger's smile, or a spring day, or your favorite book in bed. When you've lost sight of the magic of the little things, it's not because the magic has gone elsewhere, only that you've chosen to disregard it in favor of something else. 3. You have something you wanted in the past, but you don't enjoy it the way you thought you would, or you've replaced your desire for it with a desire for something else. Bring yourself back to the feeling of wanting what you have more than anything, the way you once did. Try to embody that. You're making yourself prouder than you realize. 4. If you were to tell your younger self what your life is like now, they'd be in disbelief. You seriously could not have imagined that your life would turn out as well as it did, that the worst things became turning points, not endless black holes of emotion. 5. You think of money in terms of obligation, not opportunity. Your mindset is, I have to pay my bills, as opposed to, I get to pay my bills, which house me, clothe me, and feed me, and that I can pay for by myself. If you don't value money by appreciating what it does for you, you'll never feel as though you have enough. 6. You think you don't have enough friends. You're measuring the connection in your life by a quantity, not a quality, assuming that the problem is not enough around you, when it's really that there's not enough inside you. 7. You're either over-reliant or under-attached to the friends you do have. You either don't keep in touch enough, or you get easily frustrated because you think that friends should make you feel better and happy in an unrealistic way. So you think that the only way to achieve that is to overbond yourself to them or disregard them when they don't fulfill the role you've imposed on them, hence your feeling as though you don't have enough. 8. You imagine your life as though someone else was seeing it. Before you make a decision, you recite a storyline in your head. It goes something like this. She went to college. She got this job. She married this guy after a terrible breakup. And all was well. This is what happens when your happiness starts to come from how other people feel about you, as opposed to how you feel about yourself. 9. Your goals are outcomes, not actions. Your goals are to be successful, or see a certain number in the bank, as opposed to enjoy what you do each day, no matter what you're doing, or learn to love saving more than frivolously spending. Outcomes are just ideas. Actions are results. 10. You assume you have time. When it comes to doing what really matters to you, reconnecting with family, writing that book, finding a new job, you say, I'm only such and such an age. I have a long time. If you assume you have time to do something, or that you'll do it later, you probably don't want it as much as you think you do. There isn't more time. You don't know. You could be dead tomorrow. It doesn't mean you have to get everything done today, but that there's rarely an excuse not to start. 11. A bad feeling becomes a bad day. You think that experiencing negative emotions is a result of something being wrong in your life, when in reality, it's usually just a part of being human. Anxiety serves us. Pain serves us. Depression does too. These things are signals, communications, feedbacks, and precautions that literally keep us alive. Until you begin thinking this way, all you will perceive is that good feelings mean keep going, and bad feelings mean stop, and wonder why you're paralyzed. 12. You think that being uncomfortable and fearful means you shouldn't do something. Being uncomfortable and fearful means you definitely should. Being angry or indifferent means you definitely shouldn't. 13. You wait to feel motivated or inspired before you act. Losers wait to feel motivated. People who never get anything done wait to feel inspired. Motivation and inspiration are not sustaining forces. They crop up once in a while, and they're nice while they're present. But you can't expect to be able to summon them any given hour of the day. You must learn to work without them, to gather your strength from purpose, not passion. 14. You maladaptively daydream. Maladaptive daydreaming is when you imagine extensive fantasies of an alternative life that you don't have to replace human interaction or general function. Most people experience it while listening to music and or moving, walking, riding in a car, pacing, swinging, etc. Rather than cope with issues in life, you just daydream to give yourself a high that eliminates the uncomfortable feeling. 15. You're saving up your happiness for another day. You're sitting on the train on the way to work, thinking how beautiful the sunrise looks, and how you'd like to read your favorite book, but you don't, in favor of checking your email again. You begin to feel a sense of awe at something simple and beautiful and stop yourself, because your dissatisfaction fuels you. You're creating problems in one area of your life to balance out thriving in another, because your happiness is in a mental container. 31. Do you argue intelligently, from defensiveness to rebuttal, the seven main ways people fight? At its most basic level, argumentativeness is a reflex, not a choice. When we feel threatened in some way, we either respond by fleeing, freezing, or fighting. Eventually, most people begin to realize that unconsciously responding to random external stimuli is exhausting at best, and destructive at worst. We begin to censor our responses to things. These are the seeds of self-awareness. However, this does not mean that arguing doesn't serve an important purpose. While it is often a product of grappling with our own threatened sense of identity, it is also how we can communicate feeling strongly about something important. When done intelligently, someone who knows how to argue well can be a master of their social surroundings, in business, love, and so on. The first step to doing so, however, is not sounding as though you're being argumentative. Enter the hierarchy. To put it bluntly, there are a lot of idiotic ways that people try to argue with one another, and most of them do not work. They only leave both parties more frustrated, ultimately because they each avoid addressing the real issue in its entirety. Name-calling. You deflect from the issue at hand by proclaiming that someone is an ass or an idiot, without any argument to back it up. Ad hominem. You attack the character or the authority of the person without addressing the actual substance of the argument. If someone who smokes says, "Smoking is bad," you respond, "Who are you to say?" rather than seeing it as an objective truth. Responding to tone. You criticize the tone or the diction of the person making the argument as a means of deflecting from actually addressing the argument itself. Contradiction. You state the opposing case with little or no evidence to back it up. You're arguing for the sake of it. You just inherently do not want to validate or agree with the person for some reason. Counterargument. You contradict the statement, then back it up with reasoning and or supportive evidence. Refutation. You find the mistake in the argument and explain why it is a mistake using direct quotations or inferences from the person's original statement. Refuting the central point. You explicitly refute the central point of the argument, providing sound logic and reason, if not research or personal experience, to back up your claim. 32. Signs your mental breakdown is actually an emotional breakthrough. 1. You're questioning everything. You're done believing that things are as they appear, or that what you were raised to believe about something is the right way to think overall. You're exploring new ideas of philosophy and spirituality and politics and thought, and you're coming to find that you didn't know what you didn't know. Two, you're realizing that there's a difference between happy thoughts and happy feelings. You've been trying to fill yourself up with happy thoughts forever, only to find that you get attached to a certain outcome that doesn't become reality, and you're even unhappier in the first place. You're realizing that there's a difference between a way of thinking that lets you enjoy the moment and a way of thinking that makes you happy about potentials, possibilities, and things that are everything but what's actually happening. Three, you're starting to see patterns. You're realizing that many of the things that keep resurfacing in your life, relationships, jobs, ideas, feelings, are products of what you believe they are or should be. They are patterns, and maybe if you could figure out how to change them, the way they emerge would change too. Four, you feel irrationally angry. Anger is a good emotion, that is, when you finally figure out that you're not mad at the world, you're mad at yourself. This is usually what happens right before change is going to be made. Anger is younger siblings. Dissatisfaction, resentment, irritation, self-pity, etc., are unpleasant, but not disturbing enough to make you act. Anger makes you act. It burns through you and delivers you somewhere new. Five, you're starting to question, is this all there is? You're starting to wonder whether or not you really were meant to just sleep, eat, work, then die. You're starting to wonder if this is all that exists, or if it's a small aperture for a far greater reality. Six, you had the million-dollar idea, found the relationship, got the big break, and all of a sudden you're paralyzed. We call this some good old resistance. When we perceive happiness, we perceive fear to an equal degree. It's not actually that you're resisting your new life. It's that you're very clearly identifying what you want and experiencing a natural and balanced amount of fear about it. Seven, it seems like your emotional state is unwarranted. You shouldn't feel anxious and depressed, but you do. There's no reason for your irrational fears, but they're there. You can't quite make sense of what you're feeling, and you realize that's because you're in the process of developing that skill. Eight, you're uncertain about who you really are. You have to come to terms with the fact that you've defined yourself based on either how people see you or how you think you should be, and there's a bit of a discrepancy between what you think you want and what you actually want. Nine, you're experiencing feelings and fears you had when you were a kid. It's all coming back up to the surface, and what you're realizing is that it was never really gone in the first place. The thoughts, ideas, beliefs, and feelings you kept tucked away were silently guiding your life. You just didn't know. 10. You're terrified of loss right now. Namely, you're terrified of losing one specific thing that you think in some way will save you, even just emotionally. This is what happens when you begin to realize that nothing can do that for you. You're not afraid of loss. You're afraid of being forced to accept that reality before you think you're ready. 11. You're giving up on the things you need to give up on. You're not giving up on your dreams. You're not giving up on your relationship. You are simply giving up on the idea that these things will be something more than what they are. You are giving up on what's not right for you. You're learning that giving up is such a negative term for something that's really healthy when necessary. 12. You've decided you're not going to be the victim of your own mind anymore. People don't have breakdowns unless they are on the precipices of breakthroughs. Breakdowns, or any kind of intense mental emotional turmoil, are always a sign that things are in the process of changing. Otherwise, they'd just be normal. You're done accepting your old normal, and you're on to bigger, better, brighter, happier things. 33. How to stop worrying about how your life looks and start focusing on how it feels. Count how many times you've really been happy after you got something you thought you wanted. What happened after you got the relationship you were lusting after? What happened after you got that job? What happened when you made more money? Chances are things were different, but proportionately good and bad. Make a list of all the imperfect people you've known in your life who have had love, who have had romantic partners and best friends and jobs you could only ever dream of. Make a list of all the people who are conventionally unattractive and spiritually adrift and imperfect, and all the things each one of them had despite being that way. Make it your own personal proof that you do not need to be perfect to be good enough. Ask yourself what you'd do if social media were no object and nobody would know. What would you do this Saturday? What would you do tonight? What would your career goals be? How many photos would you really take? Who would you hang out with? Where would you live if you weren't silently policing yourself through the lens of what other people see? Ask yourself what you'd do if money were no object and you could do anything. This is a classic exercise that many people dismiss because of how impractical it is. Unfortunately, those people aren't thinking deeply enough to understand the real point. It's not to discover what you'd actually do if you didn't have to worry about money. That's not our reality. It's about the essence of what you do and how you can incorporate that into your everyday life. Would you vacation? Would you keep your current job? It just goes to show you whether you value relaxation or accomplishments or whatever else. And understanding what you value is crucial to understanding who you are. Take photos to remember happy moments, not prove that you looked good or did something cool. Make a special album on your phone just for happy moments. When you feel good or are enjoying yourself or have some kind of revelation, just take a photo of whatever's in front of you, however unworthy of Instagram it is. When you look back at these seemingly random snapshots, you'll experience those feelings all over again. You'll see, by contrast, the emotional difference between capturing the moments that matter to you and creating moments to matter for other people. Identify the people you always think are judging you. You know how people always say that? People are judging me. I'm worried about what people will think. Most of the time, these people are a faceless crowd that only exist in your mind. In other words, they're you, projected outward. It's what you're judging yourself for. The first step is realizing that the people you worry about don't really exist. Think about what makes you feel the most jealous. The things that make us the most jealous and envious are usually the things that we feel we're not living up to within ourselves. We're jealous of the beautiful girl, not because we want to be beautiful like her, but because we're lacking something so much more important, which is love for ourselves. We're jealous of the successful writer, not because we also want to be lauded, but because we know we're not doing the work to get there. Don't clean before someone comes over. Save for people who, you know, aren't hygienic. Don't worry about setting up a stage when someone else visits. I'm not talking about straightening up or putting personal items away, but actually trying to construct an appearance that is a physical equivalent of bleached blonde hair dye. Let people into your life in a true way. Let them enter a moment in your life just as it's happening. It's the only way you truly bond. Rethink how you celebrate the most important days of the year. Most people do it with relatives they see only on holidays, who they don't have genuine relationships with otherwise, and who they are vaguely unhappy to have to see. These days are meant to be spent treating the people who love you all year round to parties and meals and gifts, not the people who you feel morally obligated, but emotionally repressed into stomaching. Get rid of things that aren't purposeful or meaningful. The reason why this is so important is because things are defining, especially when we buy them with the intention of making us different. Our things construct our experiences. They create what we see and, by extension, how we feel. They are the means through which we put ourselves together each day. It's not about having as little as possible. It's about having only things that serve purpose or hold meaning. Do it. It will transform your life. And that's no small claim to make. Ask yourself, if I knew nobody would judge me, what would I stand for? What do you inherently agree with once you're past all the self-imposed social filters? People think being conscious of their hidden thoughts and feelings and prejudices equal being unaware and ignorant, but the opposite is true. It's being unaware that's a problem. Ask yourself, if I could tell every single person in the world just one thing, one sentence, what would it be? Would you say, it's going to be okay? Don't worry so much. Seek the best in others. Follow me on Twitter. What you think you'd want to say to everyone out there is actually a projection of what you most need to hear. That's what you most want to tell you. Decide that to be worthy of something is just to be grateful to have it. You choose what your self-esteem is measured by. You decide what your worth is based on. You decide whether or not you're good enough for something, and because that is the case, you decide that the people who are worthy of what they have are the ones who are grateful to have it. Nothing more, nothing less. Realize that you are not only as accomplished as you are over your biggest hurdle. You're not only as good as you are perfect. You're not only as good as you are better than someone else either. In the words of Oprah, who else? You can have everything, just not at the same time. Be grateful for this. It means you have the opportunity to appreciate what's in front of you, and you always have something else to work toward and look forward to. Assume that all things are for the best. When people care most about how their lives look is when they're most closed to how their lives feel. When they're most closed to how their lives feel is when they don't want to feel pain. Being truly at peace requires realizing that everything is for the best. Everything in your life does one of three things: shows you to yourself, heals a part of yourself, or lets you enjoy a part of yourself. If you adopt that perspective, there's nothing left to fear. Ask yourself, if the whole world were blind, how many people would I impress? Truly imagine a life in which you could not see things, in which all that exists is how you feel and how you make others feel. In this kind of world, what kind of person are you? And is it for those reasons that, perhaps, creating a life that looks good to earn other people's love has supplemented having your own? 34. Why you shouldn't seek comfort. 1. Your brain can't differentiate good from bad. It only knows comfortable and uncomfortable. This is a pretty raw example, but it's the reason why criminals never think their actions are wrong. They think they're justifiable. It's why we do things we objectively know are bad for us and confuse them for feeling good. 2. You don't want what you want. You want what you've known. We are literally incapable of predicting an outcome that is out of the realm of what we've known previously. So rather than trying to seek better, we seek the best of what we've known, even if the best is really just the solution to a problem we didn't need to create again. 3. Familiar discomfort feels the same as comfort, which is why so many people are stuck in ruts or absolutely do not want to change even though they know it's what would be best for them. 4. There's no such thing as true security. We seek comfort, believing that it makes us safe, but we live in a world in which there is no such thing as true security. Our bodies were made to evolve. Our physical items are temporary and can be lost and broken, etc. To combat this, we seek comfort rather than accepting the transitory nature of life. 5. The only way you grow is by stepping into the unknown. It's why so many people have breakdown before breakthrough moments. Often their lives are leading them to better possibilities than they thought possible. They just didn't know it was good at the time. 6. Most people don't change until not changing is a less comfortable option. But there's usually a long period of time of increasing discomfort before not changing is the worst-case scenario. The universe whispers until it screams, and happy people listen while the call is still quiet. 7. There are two mindsets people tend to have, explorer or settler. Our society has a settler mindset. Our end goals are finalizing, home, marriage, career, etc., in a world that was made for evolution, in selves that do nothing but grow and expand and change. People with explorer mindsets are able to actually enjoy what they have and experience it fully because they're inherently unattached. 8. There's no such thing as real comfort. There's only the idea of what's safe. This is a big one to swallow, but there's really no such thing as comfort, which is why comfortable things don't last, and why the best adjusted people are most comfortable in discomfort. Comfortable is just an idea. You choose what you want to base yours on. 9. Life isn't about being certain. It's about trying anyway. Comfort is essentially certainty. You can either choose to be certain about what you've known or certain that you'll make the best of whatever happens. Guess who has a better time? Because nobody is ever really certain. The people who have lives they love try anyway. 35. The 6 pillars of self-esteem. Why it is not how you feel, but what you think you're capable of. We tend to think of self-esteem as a static thing, a state in which your mind naturally fuels you with positive, supportive thoughts, never being too deeply influenced by any doubts or dislikes. This, however, is where the fine line between self-esteem and self-aggrandizement blurs. In the words of Anna Devereaux Smith, self-esteem is what really gives us a feeling of well-being. It's the very inherent sense that everything's going to be all right, because we are capable of making it all right. Self-esteem is knowing that we can determine our own course, and that we can travel that course. It's not that we travel the course alone, but we need the feeling of agency, that if everything were to fall apart, we could find a way to put things back together again. Self-esteem is not how much confidence you have in how well people perceive you, but how much confidence you have in whether or not you can manage your life. What's interesting about having real self-esteem is that it eliminates the need to focus on how we're superior to others. When we don't feel we're actually in control of our lives, or aren't happy with how things are going so far, we often focus on how much better things are than someone else, to placate the feeling of failure. Nathaniel Brandon outlined what exactly it takes to build a healthy sense of self. He notes particularly that people either take the feel-good approach, I am beautiful, I am rich, I am successful, which is merely a substitute for the real thing, or they build it in a genuine way. He says that the two fundamental elements self-esteem boils down to are self-efficacy, which is a sense of basic confidence in the face of life's challenges, and self-respect, a sense of being worthy of happiness. Self-esteem is not an emotion which fluctuates from moment to moment, but a continuing disposition to experience a sense of efficacy and respect for oneself. Thus, it is something which is built over a long period of time, not just wished into existence. It is reality-based. Undeserved praise, whether it comes from oneself or others, will not provide it. Here are the 6 practices, or pillars, on which Brandon argues self-esteem can be built. They prove that it is not just a choice to feel confident in yourself, but it's many choices, made continuously, and with as much effort as possible. Living consciously. To live consciously is to not be controlled by your subconscious biases and desires. Your shadow selves, as they're called, are out in the light. You understand what's going on around you, and you can make informed choices based on that inherent understanding. Self-acceptance. You aren't aggrandizing your looks or your intelligence or being willfully ignorant of the natural balance of traits and characteristics every person possesses. This is true self-acceptance. It is seeing your whole self without judging or condemning parts of it. Self-responsibility. You hold yourself accountable for your own happiness. You understand the phrase, "It may not be your fault, but it is still your problem." You are in control of your life because you are not letting other things do it for you. Self-assertiveness. You can stand up for yourself without being defensive. Defensiveness is born of fear. Assertiveness is born of confidence. Living purposefully. You live mindfully and intentionally. You recognize that your purpose is just to be where you are, doing whatever you're doing. In this, you infuse your days with a sense of purposefulness, as it is something you choose, not wait to find or have created for you. Personal integrity. You hold yourself to a certain standard of morals and ethics and accountability. You develop a code of conduct for yourself, rather than just abiding by the one that you are conditioned to. You are able to look at choices objectively, even when the circumstances are difficult. You realize the importance of the phrase, "The road to hell was paved with good intentions." 36. Why you should thank the people who have hurt you most in life. 1. The people who are able to hurt you most were also the people whom you were able to love the most. We aren't profoundly affected by people who aren't already deeply within our hearts. For someone to have that much importance in your life is sacred, even when it goes askew. It's a gift to know someone who is able to truly affect you, even if at first it didn't seem like it was for the best. 2. Difficult relationships often push you to change your behavior for the better. In feeling helpless, you learn to take care of yourself. In feeling used, you recognize your worth. In being abused, you develop compassion. In feeling like you're stuck, you realize there is always a choice. In accepting what was done to you, you realize that nobody has control at the end of the day. But in surrendering the need for something we'll never have, we can find peace, which is what we were actually seeking in the first place. 3. What you learn and who you become is more important than how you temporarily feel. That relationship may have seemed almost unbearable at the time, but the feeling is transitory. The wisdom and grace and knowledge that you carried with you afterwards aren't. They set a foundation for the rest of your life. The ends far outweigh the means, and to be grateful for what you've been through is to completely acknowledge that. 4. You don't come across these people by accident. They were your teachers and catalysts. In the words of C. Joybel C., "We're all stars that think they're dying until we realize we're collapsing into supernovas, to become more beautiful than ever before." It often takes the contrast of pain to completely appreciate what we have, and it often takes hate to incite self-recognition. Sometimes the way light enters us is, in fact, through the wound. 5. Even if it wasn't your fault, it is your problem, and you get to choose what you do in the aftermath. You have every right to rage and rant and hate every iota of someone's being, but you also have the right to choose to be at peace. To thank them is to forgive them, and to forgive them is to choose to realize that the other side of resentment is wisdom. To find wisdom in pain is to realize that the people who become supernovas are the ones who acknowledge their pain and then channel it into something better, not people who just acknowledge it and then leave it to stagnate and remain.